Accession number 13717, Lieutenant Colonel Charles G. Reel 18.
Colonel G, Reel 18. We were talking about the rather confused period towards the end of the war. One thing, you mentioned that you'd lost weight. Why exactly was that? Had they stopped?
German rations had got very poor, and Red Cross parcels had stopped. And the Germans ordered, and knew we had a big stock of Red Cross parcels and food, and they ordered to have it all eaten by Christmas. So that gives a rough date.
Christmas 44 was just 5 months of war to come.
Ate fairly hard. Then we didn't get Red Cross parcels, and the last Red Cross parcels we did get were damaged by bullets and things. They didn't issue any more, and we ate a lot, and then we hid a lot, hadn't used none, so our food and the German rations were much worse, and I think it was that, it may have been a length of time, but I lost a stone and a half in the last little bit and got a bit upset inside, and then we were trying to march, well there were 50 of us in one night.
Which way were you heading? We're heading east.
Away, I suppose, heading into Germany with the Americans. Coming roughly north, I suppose. Northeast, the route would be. And
you were heading towards the Americans or towards the Russians?
Oh, towards Berlin. I was just to be away from. And after a bit, we just said we wouldn't march. We couldn't. There was 50 of us got hurt. And we said we wouldn't go by train. Then we'd go by bus if they sent buses. Eventually,
now, how could you do these things? Like you mentioned before, you refused to march at night. Well, now you're refusing to march. Couldn't they have just made you?
Well, they couldn't really without bullets. And they knew the war was coming to an end, and they wanted to finish, I think. And we persuaded them to stop. And then we realised we were likely to be in the middle of a river battle. And so we did move on one more march. We got to a village where we really took charge. We were put in to live in a cinema, and we walked out around the village swapping what we carried, like cigarettes for an egg and so on. And
do you know the name of the village?
No, I don't know the name of the village. But then we realised that the surrounding district was full of Germans and might have patches of German soldiers, and they might be coming back with a friend just killed, and they'd shoot us. And so we had to be careful walking around the village. We were terrified of being fired on by the...
Were you guarded at all?
No.
The guards had gone?
Guarded? Well, it was there, but nobody was bothering. We walked about the village quite free, we didn't ask permission. And the final day, I personally had been out a quarter of a mile away, out clear of the village, with a whole lot of white things on the ground, trying to signal to aeroplanes that they were not to bomb the place. When we were marching, we were very near an attack on a station. A frightening noise.
A bombing attack?
Bombing and shooting attack on a station. But we were pretty scared about that. And I came back into the village lavatory and said, where are the Americans? And they were only 2 kilometres away from us. And I said, how do you know? And I said, oh, somebody said telephone. I said, why don't we telephone back? I was heard by the senior British officer. I said, Henry, get on that phone. In 2 minutes, he's talking to an American. and asked and got on to a senior one, and I told him there were, I think, 400 British officers within reach, just a few kilometres away, and that we could they rescue us? And they had a debate about it, and said they were already rather too far to the left, and it'd bring them a bit more to the left, but they decided to chance it, and they sent lorries through to take us away. And we got in. We had, the Germans had sent one lorry, we'd sabotaged it so it wouldn't go, and we knew they wanted to surrender. And then, to one of the most interesting things in my life, there was a German boy, spoke a little English, and he thought all Americans were black, as both the people in the village did, and he wanted to meet the Americans, and he led the way, and I and a few others followed him to meet the American patrol coming through. And we eventually met an officer about 20 years old, looking very scared, and he had an orderly with him 10 yards away behind a hedge or something, and he was astonished to see us, and we led him back towards the village. As we got a little further on, our major came and knelt in the road and handed over his sword. I didn't picture anybody doing like that since Trafalgar or something.
The major of the German Guard.
Yes. And the American took it and didn't know what to do with it. And we got round the corner a bit more. There was all our guard, I didn't realize there were so many, 20 or 30 of them, they all handed over their rifles to us, being guarded by officers or orderlies. And this officer went in and telephoned to his company commander, and then a big argument occurred as to whether they could send things over, and they did eventually take the chance. And they sent a number of lorries at night, it wasn't very far, and they didn't take us to that village, they took us some distance to a great big aerodrome, huge thing, as big as the Fulton thing, and gave us an enormous meal, which upset me, American meal, paraded us and said, our absolute fantastic astonishment, we are not fighting troops here. We've got this aerodrome. We can't use it because the Germans got the land outside it. We haven't any fighting troops within 20 miles. We're arming all of you, and you're back in the war. So we were armed. My party was guarding German prisoners in a hut, but a lot of people were patrolling the perimeter of the camp, and there were Germans the other side of the perimeter. And quite a number of bombs.
Hostile Germans?
What?
Hostile Germans?
Yes, hostile. Quite a lot of bombs and grenades and things arrived at the camp. We could hear explosions all the time, so there was some vague danger. None of us got hit, but that went on for 2 days before some real American soldiers arrived. They panned out across the aerodrome into the brushwood. And within 5 minutes, first aeroplane landed, unloaded itself, and 25 others got in it to fly first to Paris. But halfway there, I got a signal to go to Havre instead. And we crossed the old battlefields of the First War. You could see all the trenches just as if they were new, from the height. And presumably other planes came, because a whole lot arrived in Havre that night, and we were taken to a camp, fed, and next day we got into aeroplanes, and everybody thanking God it was the Americans, because they didn't shout and drill us and just said next 25 into a plane, and it was simple and short, and we got into planes and landed in England, somewhere near in Oxford and London.
How did you feel then after all those years?
I was sick, ill, and I think I made myself sick before the flight, instead of being sick over people, and my tummy was terribly upset.
Was that with the richer diet, or just eating too
much? Probably. I had been, before the retired, pretty odd inside, for a day or two out of my back passage. I came not what I wanted to come, but more or less pure uncoloured water. And it happened still. The last year or two it's come on again. And it's really awkward. And I don't know, I can't control it. But whether there's any connection between the two, I don't know.
So anyway, you were
it was
Ill.
Very exciting. And when we were due to go to Paris, I thought, oh, I'd be able to buy some wonderful presents for my wife, forgetting that I had no money. But one might have done it on credit. The French would be. Officers would probably take it. Anyway, the tragic thing is motoring in these buses driven by black men very fast was that the bus in front of me, somebody who happened to have been in my house and just leaning over the back, lost his false teeth. All his false teeth. So on the way home, he had nothing in his mouth at all. I more or less funked it. Went to the loo, everybody went into tea, but it was a marvellous welcome and tea party. This was a month before the end of the war, you see. And very few prisoners had escaped or arrived or been rescued. So we were some of the first in England. They were very excited about us. And the welcome was marvellous. And we went to some place where they vague medical inspection, which was far too vague. I ought to be sent to hospital, I think, for a week or two to recover. But they gave us money and London, and it took down our particulars, and people telephoned. I got the telephones over after midnight. My wife got woken and agreed to meet me at her sister's flat in London. It was Prince of Wales Mansions, POW Mansions, Chelsea. And I got there before her. I had some flowers. The key was hidden under the doormat, of course. Stupid places. But got in and all was well. There was no water. Well, there was water, but we had to boil water in a kettle to pass me. I'm absolutely filthy. Had an enormous number of flea lumps on me. Quite disgusting. We had in the big camp there were lots of fleas. Otherwise, life as a prisoner of war was free, except the bed bugs in Poland. Fleas in the big camp, I found my. Thing I slept in, a sort of thing you use for camping. I turned it inside out with little blood marks all over it. I just took it out in the cold and the freezer all froze. And it was all right, washed later. But otherwise, I have been free of that sort of trouble. But then in England, I found I had double rations for either 6 months or a year. That wasn't really a good idea because I ate too much. But it was frightfully exciting being in London. I got cleaned. My wife got a new uniform made for me. And I dressed as an officer again. Bought a pair of shoes, which were too tight as my feet swelled. And hot weather came. But when we went out to dinner at some big restaurant I knew the name of, there was a big queue waiting to get in. And as a prisoner of war, we went to the front of the queue and got the last food in the restaurant, 3 hours. And it was very difficult to settle down to home life.
A lot of prisoner of wars had trouble when they came back, being able to readjust to civilian life.
It took a long time, really.
What sort of problems did you have?
My wife, I think, thought that I didn't realise I wasn't well. I mean, I wasn't anything like well for over a year. and problems of going back to school.
Were you demobilised almost straight away then? Because you'd be of the age group to be demobilised.
Well, I did take part in a general election. I went round talking to people about voting for Churchill, and Labour got in with a huge majority. I did some political work.
Whereabouts? In Bristol?
In that's my wife's home town, in Derbyshire. I went to Bristol, and the headmaster said, he knew I'd been, I'd have to be reinstated in my job as a housemaster, but I wasn't fit, I didn't know any boys, and the headmaster suggested a compromise. Well, the house was closed when you went, and there it is closed now, but there's so many people wanting to come that it'll be open almost certainly in a year. And I said, well, I'll wait for a year and open that new house for you, which eventually turned out a busy, tricky job because there was no furniture in it. And when the boys came, there was still no furniture in it. It was ordered and hadn't come. And the difficulties were incredible. One day before they came, there wasn't a hook for them, and my school couldn't buy them. And my house tutor went and bought them. The shop and tripped to a few people. I was sorry for us. They'd do anything for me, I suppose, as back as a prisoner of war, ex-prisoner of war. But I had a carpenter that virtually lived in the house for a whole term.
And so you settled...
The school's expense, not mine.
How long was it before you settled back into life, civilian life?
Well, something like a year.
When had you actually been demobilised? I'm not clear about
that. Oh, very quickly. I don't know exactly when, but fairly quickly. I was a good age by then, you see, I was 48.
Now,
I did put in for headmastership, but, and in a sense, I nearly got it. But I wasn't fit. I mean, I was glad not to get it. My wife was disappointed. She didn't want to go back to Clifton because the headmaster sacked me for leaving. But he was all right.
That was a point. I'd forgotten that, but he took you back. Had he changed his attitude? And how
well,
did you...
I had to. It's done my act of Parliament.
And how did you feel about him?
Well, I didn't mind. He was quite nice then. And yes, I think it was all right. He didn't bear any grudges or anything. He went off fairly quickly to university. Nottingham. He's still alive, and I didn't know him a bit, and found the new headmaster very nice. But the job of starting a house with volunteers from other houses, because nobody would want to leave his friends to go to a new house.
Now, what
they
about
didn't know me, they didn't know anything, I was rather old for them. Going back to school, knowing nobody, and was very difficult. I was very tired, and we had to fix up a flat and cope with two children. And
what was it like meeting the children again, one you'd never seen?
That was a big thrill. They thought, my wife said, I've got red hair, and they thought red is a pillar box. And we got to the station, and I said I'd walk home, and didn't realise that everybody knew I was coming, and they all turned out. As our children were waiting halfway, I met them. One I'd seen before, was a thing about so long.
A 12-inch, a baby.
The other one I hadn't heard of. I mean, I'd heard of, but was born about 8 months after I was a prisoner. And they were very shy, and I was, and it was exciting meeting them, because I didn't know them. And when they... We started at Clifton without them because we were making a flat out of nothing and got some of our furniture out of store. My wife was slaving away and kept me up for about one or two every morning helping get the flat ready for the children and the servant that we had from her mother, K. gave us one of her servants. But it was very, very hard work, being unknown. And we got all the duds, all the people that volunteered to come. I said, I'd take anybody as long as I was told what they were. But I wasn't told. I caught five of them thieving in a year, and I had some awful problems. But it, they gradually left or grew up, and we got away with it, and the thing became fun. And then, but it was a big strain, and fortunately we had another child, a third child, and our wife was 44, I think, or something then, getting pretty old, but the babies solved all problems between us. We'd got a bit apart from work and this and that. She didn't realize that I was unfit. And then when she had another baby, everything was marvelous. So, and then the military part.
Yes, because you joined the Home Guard, the Home Guard of some sort, didn't you?
She'd been in the in uniform before the war, and when we were at her home, before I came back to Clifton for some sort of parade, she was marching past her to salute me with her girl guides or whatever it was she got there. She was very active with all the war, worked like a black, collecting money and doing this and that. And my car got worn out, their car bust, and she got mine. And life became more or less perfect. I got a house, I got staff again.
Now you still kept on your link with the army, because you got your colonelcy from the Home Guard, didn't you?
The Home Guard. The Home Guard was restarted because of fears of Russian dropping. Starting a war and dropping people to destroy Avonmouth and the aeroplane factory in Bristol. So that was primarily what we were doing. And I knew the brigadier of TA before the war. My colonel I knew from Clifton or the territorials.
Did it have a name, the unit of the Home Guard? What was it called?
It did have a name, but I've forgotten. It was a battalion, and I had four company commanders, all majors and things. People like me that had been in the war.
So you were in command of the battalion?
I was second in command, and then they decided to reduce the Home Guard, and it was reduced to a cadre, and my colonel went up to be brigadier, and I went up to be colonel. But the card I never paraded. It was just—it's a good way of stopping a thing. If you're wrong, it could have been restarted again in a moment by just leaving a nominal card. And that's my only right to be a colonel, having four majors under me.
And when did that stop?
It must have been somewhere in the '50s.
Now, at one point. Thing you made was you mentioned in the interview that you quite enjoyed, not enjoyed perhaps, but the First World War wasn't too bad for you. Could you comment on that?
I liked the First World War.
What did you like? That's unusual, isn't it? What did you like about it?
The happiest time of my life when I was doing what everybody else was doing. Nothing to concentrate on except just winning the war. I was lucky under Bradford. Very lucky, because a lot of people wouldn't have that outlook. And my brain was stretched all the time. And when ordinary life, there are all sorts of interests and snags, and you're wondering what is worth doing, etc. Looking back on it, one felt one had been through a big adventure and got away with it and done fairly satisfactory work.
So it was the sense of purpose, and
I think so, yes.
What about the privations and the fear, I presume?
It doesn't matter if you're with other people. I mean, making a hole in the ground and living it for 3 days is quite easy. I didn't myself have to do much to do with mud and coal. I mean, the two parts of the war that were awful, or the three parts, the killings on the Somme. But people were fairly happy about the Somme. People that survived it didn't worry. The Ypres thing was much worse, according to all I've read about it and seen. But we survived that. And I don't know, well, the Saturday that got away with something. The real part of the war I enjoyed was Pocahontas. I got caught up with my job and lovely weather and a bit of ordinary life, but Shelter was doing good in getting the whole battalion passed and so on. Happy times.